Today's presenters is Nancy Trent and Keith. Nancy Trent is the team lead for West Application Server for ZOS Level 2 support team. Nancy joined L2 support in 2000 and has been with the West Application Server for ZOS since 1997. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Nancy and Keith.
Thanks, Elijah. And I'd just like to take a quick minute to introduce my teammate, Keith Debkuga. He's been with our Level 2 team for 5 years now and is one of our most skilled debuggers. At this point in time, I'd like to start on Chart 2 to go through a quick overview of the agenda of what we'll cover today. We've categorized this presentation into a few different sections. The first sections will be going through some problems that Level 2 frequently sees related to storage leaks, security SSL, hangs, install slash maintenance upgrades, and lastly, high CPU and performance. Then we'll take you through some new interesting items with regards to timeout enhancements. There's a section of additional information which we won't go through chart by chart unless we have time. There's a few things in there from past presentations we've given that we've seen as other common problems, but for the sake of time, we needed to move those to a different section of the presentation. And lastly, we'll cover helpful links and resources. On chart 3, there's just a one page about the problems. We'll start talking about those now. And on chart 4, we'll start with Java storage leaks, and I will turn that over to Keith to take us through the next couple charts.
Hi. We've been seeing a lot of problems on web server Z involving Java storage leaks. Here I'd like to just talk about some of the symptoms that we see and what the web server level 2 team uses for diagnostics. Usually a Java storage leak will have some indication of a Java laying out of memory somewhere in the Java output or the application log. These can be hidden sometimes because we have customers using various types of logging, such as Java util logging or Log4j, some of the open source logging APIs. With a Java laying out of memory, it doesn't always mean it's an out of memory in Java heap. Sometimes it can be related to heap fragmentation. And we'll be covering what to look for in the GC output to try to determine if it really is an out of memory or something with heap fragmentation. With the out of memory, you may also experience an OC4 add-in and a subsequent generated tdump. The OC4 will usually have a region code 2 or a region code 4. And out in the HFS, you'll have a binary portable heap dump and a Java core ASCII file. And these are usually generated in the slash temp directory on the Z system. For diagnostics, we use verbose GC tracing just to confirm whether or not we really do have an out of memory from exhausting the heap or for something that may be a slow leak that's accumulating over time. We use tools such as Heap Analyzer and MDB4J for looking at a binary portable heap dump, and Thread Analyzer for looking at the Java Core ASCII file. The Java Core ASCII file, you can also just browse it since it is an ASCII, just to look at the stack traces. SCCdump.jar is one of the more popular tools that we use in case all we get is just a dump. We can format out the stack traces using the SCCdump.jar tool. To page 5. Page 5, when we do get information from a customer and they indicate they have a Java laying out of memory, one of the first things we suggest is turning on verbose GC tracing. It's something that can be turned on in a production environment. It doesn't produce too much output, but it does give us an idea of how the system is running over an extended period of time. Some of the things that we look for is the percentage free, to see if that percentage free with each GC invocation is decreasing continuously over time, or if it hits some point and then eventually kind of stabilizes at a certain point. If you notice it continuing to decrease over an extended period of time, eventually it'll hit 0%. Customers may report things as high CPU as the GC cycle starts to increase, and a portable heat dump and a T dump will be generated. One problem that customers have is that they never send us the T-dump because the T-dump can't be generated because of security issues related to the high-level qualifier. WebSphere for ZOS does have an environment variable where you can change the high-level qualifier, and that variable can be changed in the Java dump, T-dump pattern. There's an example on slide 5. As we move to slide 6, this is an example output from the memory dump diagnostics tool, which is also available with the IBM Support Assistant. Whenever we do have a Java laying out of memory, we try to identify what objects in the heap may be accumulating. From a lot of the heap dumps that I have looked at, we'll notice that there will be a large number of small objects. In this example here for an application that was put together, you'll see there's a leak object with 442 children. A lot of examples that I've looked at, this number could be really high. It could be in the thousands or tens of thousands. If you use the tool, it's rather simple. You can just load your portable heat dump or the T-dump into the tool, do analysis, and locate a leak suspect, and the tool pretty much does most of the work for you. If you look at the very top line that's highlighted, you'll see that all these objects are consuming about 460 megs of the heat, which is a good indication that there might be a leak here. Sometimes the tool may find something that might be a leak suspect, but if it's only consuming a meg or two, it might not be a leak. On slide 7 is just another tool that we use, the Heap Analyzer, and it provides pretty much the same output. I just wanted to provide this screenshot just to show you the difference between the two tools. Very similar to MDD-4J. It's useful for locating a leak suspect. I guess which tool to use depends on your preference.
Starting on chart 8, picking this back up again, another area of storage leaks that we see are in native storage, and that's opposed to Java storage. So the first part is determining if it's a native code storage leak. The symptoms are usually visible. We see some slow growth over time where the leak takes a while to build up. So if you're frequently recycling your WebSphere for application servers, that can make these slow leaks invisible. So if you're in a test mode, pre-production, you might not notice it until you get into production under higher volumes where you tend to leave your application server up for longer periods of time. Another symptom that you see for this is that it can result in a core with no memory with the minor code we've listed here from a file name that starts with BBO, which is the WebSphere runtime. The steps we take to diagnose these problems is we collect a console dump of the address spaces where the suspected leak is occurring, and we ask for those to be taken multiple times with multiple dumps with some time in between them so that we can see the growth over time of a particular area. And then we use normal ZOS storage management diagnosis, such as VSM data or LEHeap. They think these leaks can occur in subpool 2K8. When they're in other subpools, they're typically IBM product leaks. And we also use LEHeap pool tracing, which is available starting ZOS 1.5 and up. And we've listed the commands that we tend to use here. Going on to chart 9, one of the areas in these native storage leaks that we see are leaks in the JIT. And while this is Java product related, the just-in-time compiler, the JIT storage is kept in the native storage area. You can see these through Abin X78 in the servant region or other storage-related problems in addition to Abin X78. The high storage usage in these scenarios shows up in subpool 2K8. Originally, we saw these as some 4K blocks. More recently and more problematically, there's just 7.5 meg storage areas that are leaked. And we listed here on this page some APARs that we've come across. The middle bullet there, the PK36196, and the other APAR there that have shipped in SR9A, and we've picked up in WebSpheres and iFix and 60221. These are the most prevalent leaks that we've seen recently, and they do affect Java 142, SR4 through SR7, and those are the 7.5 meg leak areas. On chart 10, there's also some other leaks in the WebSphere runtime itself, where these APARs are a little bit old, but we want to make sure that people were aware of them, where they were taken in each release, and where they are fixed across the releases as we roll them forward. On chart 11, I'd like to turn this back over to Keith now to talk a little bit about SSL.
For chart 11, I'll be going over the next three slides, kind of showing you some of the things that were added to the WebSphere 6.1 administration console. And some of the things, you may have seen them there in the admin console, but they're quite useful for diagnostics. In the WebSphere 6.1, as opposed to WebSphere 5.1 and 6.0 for ZOS, all our endpoints where ports were open have been moved over to JSSC with the exception of the daemon. The daemon still uses system SSL because there's no JVM that runs in that address space. In addition, WebSphere also provides a new approach to organizing your SSL configurations. They're all centralized in one panel in the admin console. And WebSphere 5.1 and 6.0 for ZOS, you'd usually have to traverse down some really long breadcrumb trail to your endpoint and then point to a repertoire that describes your SSL settings. For WebSphere 6.1, on the same panel, you'll see that the SSL configuration, you really only need to have one SSL configuration, or you can have multiple SSL configurations because they're all scoped now. They can be scoped at the cell level, the node level, the server level, even as well as the endpoint level for both inbound connections and outbound connections. Some of the new things added to the admin console are the IKMAN-like facilities, which can be used on ZOS to view certificates that are in a key ring. For HFS-based key stores and trust stores, all the facilities are there for importing, exporting, extracting, deleting certificates. Since certificates on a key ring are read-only, you have the ability to just view the certificates. The other types of operations actually have to be done by the RACF administrator. Also, worth mentioning, for thin clients and J2E clients that may be using a soap.client.pops file or a sas.client.pops file, in WebSphere 5.1 and 6.0 for ZOS, the SSL settings were actually in these files themselves. For WebSphere 6.1, you may have noticed if you have these types of clients that these settings have been moved into an SSL configuration in the sas.client.pops file, which both the soap.client.pops and the sas.client.pops point to. Moving over to slide 12, this is just a screenshot to show you how the SSL configurations have been centralized onto one administration page. If you look at the diagram, you'll see the cell-level SSL configuration. Moving downwards, you'll see the node-level SSL configuration. And if I were to open up the outbound tree, it would look somewhat similar to the inbound tree, except those would be all the SSL configurations for any outbound requests from WebSphere. Moving on to slide 13, if you were to click on one of these SSL configurations, you'll see that it points to either a key store or trust store. The key store or trust store, depending on how you set WebSphere for ZOS up, can either point to an HFS-based file, either a JKS file or a PKCS12 file that may be in your HFS, and that can contain certificates, or it could point to a SAS keyring URI, which most customers on WebSphere through ZOS are running with. You know, the SAS keyring may point to something like the WAS keyring, and if you were to issue the RACF command, you could see your signer certificate from the display of the RACF command, or you can view it in the admin console by following this breadcrumb trail here. There's other certificates shipped with our installation job, other signer certificates, certificate authorities that are placed on the keyring but aren't visible initially, and it's because those don't have a status of trust. If you were to issue the RACF command and give it trust status, you could also view those in the admin console. Moving to slide 14, if you were to click on the signer certificate or even a personal certificate, you get a lot of useful information here, such as when the certificate was issued, when it will expire. You'll get the serial number. Serial number is great if you're exporting certificates to, say, a distributed platform. You need to confirm that you exported the correct certificate. Also with the issuer and subject, if you need to follow a certificate chain, in case there's an intermediate certificate or several intermediate certificates. You may be wondering why I'm putting so much emphasis on these three panels. Prior to WebSphere 6.1 for ZOS, there really wasn't a way to tell if you had your security set up right with key rings using the admin console. You really had to just use the RACF command. One of the nice things about being able to view your certificates from the admin console is that if you're running in a base application server, your apps and the admin console, which really is an application, are running in the same address space. If you can't view your certificates from the admin console, there's a pretty good chance that your apps aren't going to be able to access the keyring or certificates either. So as a diagnostic approach, it's quite useful to be able to confirm that you can view your certificates from the admin console before turning on global security, or if you're trying to renew certificates, do it in the admin console. This also holds true for a network deployment configuration in which all the control region user IDs are the same. The deployment manager control region user ID, the node agent user ID, and the application server control region user ID. You can also use this to diagnose whether or not the key ring and the certificates are set up correctly on the control region user ID. Moving to slide 15, in the event that you're unable to view your certificates from the admin console, or you need to get information maybe from a servant region key ring, there's some example RACF commands here. The first command will show you the certificates that are connected to a key ring for a particular user ID. We usually give these to customers to give us the information for both the control and servant region user ID. The second command will show you the details of a signer certificate. And the third command will show you the details of a personal certificate for a particular user ID. For a lot of these SSL problems, customers often ask me, what type of trace do I need to turn on? And trace usually isn't the first thing you want to start with. Really just identifying who the client is, who the server is, in the SSL handshake issue. It could be a client outside of WebSphere trying to connect to our control region. It could be WebSphere itself trying to communicate with itself. For example, synchronization between the deployment manager and the node agent. Or it could be WebSphere as a client trying to go outbound to some other server. And the other server doesn't even have to be a WebSphere server. It could be LDAP, some other web services server. Moving on to slide 16. This is just one of those problems that we keep seeing pop up over and over again related to migration, and it sometimes is misleading. Customers migrating from, say, WebSphere 5.1 to WebSphere 6.0 may see the message that the SOAP connector can't connect to the deployment manager host name and port, and that the migration job is going to roll back. And the real underlying reason is that they either submitted the job with the wrong user ID, because key rings are connected to a particular user ID, and the ID that our security job set up the key ring for is WSAdmin or equivalent, or the key ring doesn't, or the servant region key ring doesn't have the WebSphere CA signer certificate. This is just one of those common problems that we see a lot and I thought it would be worth mentioning here. Moving on to slide 17, Webster for ZOS is broken up into two address spaces, the control and servant region. Whenever you're diagnosing inbound SSL problems, you really want to be looking at the control region, because that's where all the inbound endpoints are. So if it's a HTTP call, a SOAP request, an inbound RMI over IOP call, you really want to look at the control region. When WebSphere is a client going outbound, for example, a customer may be using, say, Apache HTTP client. They may be opening up a socket in their application to go outbound, maybe using Java URL class to read a URL, or even doing some sort of web service call. You really want to be looking at the certificates on the servant region keyring, because that's going to have all the details for what might be causing an SSL issue. Moving on to slide 18, we've had a lot of customers experience hangs for various reasons. I won't be going into the details of like the timeouts and EC3s that might occur here. I just wanted to mention some of the hangs that occur because of a customer's configuration, which may be causing bottlenecks. We've worked with some customers where in a test environment, they may set up their dynamic application environment to only allow WLM to start up one servant region. So the maximum number of servant regions that will start is just one. This may work well in a test environment. However, in a production environment, when you have a heavier workload, there may not be enough servant region threads to handle all the requests coming in the WebSphere. The two settings that customers usually run with for the number of threads that they have in their servant region is either IO bound or long wait. These are the most common ones. Long wait will give you the maximum, which is 40. IO bound is the default that WebSphere ships with. The formula there looks kind of confusing, but it's really just saying a min of 5. It's 3 times the number of CPUs with a min of 5 or a max of 30. The last issue that kind of causes hangs, and it really does create a bottleneck, is when customers have set up a data source, and when you first set up a data source in WebSphere, the default for max connections is 10. Well, if you're running in a servant region address space where you may have more than 10 threads running, say you're running long wait with 40, and you have to think of your worst case scenario where you have an app going to a back-end database, you may have 40 requests coming in at the same time trying to connect to the database to execute an SQL query. However, only 10 threads will actually be executing, will get a connection and can actually proceed with executing the query, while the other 30 will just sit there waiting for the connection. So whenever you're running WebSphere and you have more threads than the number of your max connections, it's usually good to set the max connection to be at least equal to the number of threads that you're running in your servant region. There are cases where you may need to increase this if a single thread obtains more than one connection for a single TCP. Moving on to slide 19. These are some other common problems that we experience. It'll be hangs on startup and hangs when you stop a server. When a customer tries to stop a server, using the P and then the control region name to gracefully shut down the server will begin to shut down, and then it'll hang, and the servant region will just sit there in a hung state. For these types of problems, you usually get a console dump and format out the TCPs to look at the stack trace using svcdump.jar. What we see a lot of times is that the server region is hung because of a non-daemon thread. And when I say a non-daemon thread, these are usually application-started threads, or the application developer may be using some API that starts a thread on the covers, and the thread never terminates. So when we try to stop the WebSphere address space, these threads just continue to run continuously, hanging up the server. I also wanted to just mention two APARs for WebSphere 6.1 that we've seen a lot of customers hit, is the PK37761 and the PK34515 that also deal with hangs when starting kind of startup of the control region for WebSphere. and one that's related to stopping the application server. Moving on to slide 20, I'd like to hand this over to Nancy to cover some of the mismatching service problems and maintenance.
Thanks, Keith. Another frequent problem that we see is when customers upgrade maintenance level or apply service. Our WebSphere runtime code is, we actually have some C++ code, assembler, and PLX that are kept in MVS data sets that are loaded into StepLive, LPA, or LinkList, as well as Java code that resides in the runtime HFS. And if these, the levels of these two areas where we keep our code get out of sync, one is at a newer level, one's at an older level, some strange things can start happening when you try to start your servers up. So a frequent place, if you have if just apply maintenance and your servers won't start, it could be because we have these mixed levels. And there are a couple places to check where we report what levels we think we're running. In the BBOM007i message, which comes out in both the control and servant region job output, this message will tell you the level of a particular part called BBOU-binf, which contains the build string, and that is in the SBBO load data set. So that'll report what level the C++ runtime code thinks it's running at. And then the another message, BBOJ0096i, that only comes out in the control region, and it reports what level of HFS it thinks it's running. This BBOJ message is introduced in the 5160 and 6.1 releases that we've noted here. The particular fix packs are in the case of 6.1 in the base. In addition to those messages, we've taken another APAR in 6.02, which shipped in 6.02.19 here, that will report, it'll log a message in the job output that shows whether you're using any jars in the slash classes directory. You may have received a temp fix through level 2 support from a particular problem and forgotten that you had that temp fix on when you moved up in service level, causing a mismatch in the Java code that way with the service that was delivered and that previous temp fix that you had. On chart 21, if the servant region won't come up far enough for you to look at that BBOJ message, there is a way where you can manually check in the HFS what service level we think that the, your runtime HFS is running at, and that's through running the version info shell script. And we've listed here where that shell script should be located in your HFS. And when you invoke that, it will tell you either the 5.1 service level or the 6.0 or 6.1 fixed pack level, and give you some extra details, like the time of the installation. The admin console also uses the same files that version info shell script looks at to report the level that's displayed in the admin console. And we've listed a couple of places here where the admin console will pull it out of based on which release you're running. On chart 22, in addition to the runtime code that's in either StepLive LPA or LinkList, and what you have in running in the runtime HFS, there's another place where our service could be pointed to, and that's in the StepLive that could be located in your setup command line .sh. Whether you're using StepLive or not is something that you specified at configuration or customization time. So if you answered the question in the customization scripts to StepLive data sets, there's very likely that you'll have a StepLive in your setup command line .sh. And depending on how you set it up, you may need to update that data set name to the new level of service that you've just applied. And again, here we've listed where that file is located in your config HFS based on what release you're running. On chart 23, moving on to another type of problem area that we frequently see PMRs in is that, you know, out of the blue you're running along and you see high CPU condition. This can be due to other constraints on the system. It could be due to something that the WebSphere runtime is causing. It could be due to something an application's causing. But if you do see the CPU increase, a couple ways that we diagnose this is we like to maximize SysTrace that's running by issuing the MBS console command here that we have, the trace ST999K, and capture a console dump at the time that you're experiencing high CPU. And we have listed a must gather here that you can reference on the web for other things you might want to capture. Moving on to chart 24, sort of related is another area we see a lot of PMRs in is performance. Now this is really could be an entire presentation all on its own, and we actually have given this at the technical exchange a couple of years ago, but the content really hasn't changed at all and is still very relevant. You can go back and listen to that recording. We have that link listed here. There's another white paper dealing with diagnosing performance problems, a couple of white papers, as well as an IBM class. Some things that you need to remember when you're looking at performance problems is if you're moving an application from a distributed environment to ZOS, you can't necessarily compare them flat out. They might not be comparable because your distributed box may actually be bigger, and it may also be the only thing running on the distributed box. Whereas when you're running within a Web3 application server for ZOS environment, that's one thing on the ZOSL par where there are a lot of other production environments running as well. And some things to focus on are paging as well as HFS or ZFS access. There may be some tuning in those areas to ensure that your WLM goals are set up appropriately. And the fact that whether you may need to use apps or if you are using them, that they're configured properly. And the other reference material that I've listed here goes into more detail about why those things are important. On chart 25, and then chart 26. The next topic, which will take us pretty much to the end of the presentation, are some new enhancements that we've made to the area of timeout processing. And when I say timeout here, I mean the timeouts that are related to particularly the Web3 application server for ZOS product. They're an architected and designed specifically for our product. And I'm not going to go into a lot of background here. I'm assuming that most people know what they are. But they're a way of when a request that comes into the app server times out, what we do by default action is append the servant region to free up any resources that were associated with that request, such as DB2 or KIX backend type resources. So the problem here is that when you if one request comes into the app server, it could be a runaway request. And these hung applications can tie up a limited number of dispatch threads or tie up all of them, which ends up restricting throughput through the server. And if this happens enough, it can take the whole server down and tie up all the remaining threads. Chart 27. One of the new things that have been added, there's some common code within WebSphere for hang detection. And it monitors work being dispatched. It maintains its own history of how long the work has usually takes to dispatch and issues a couple of messages when it detects that it's taking longer than that usual time. We've listed the two messages here. It does dynamically adjust those expectations based on history of how the request is running. But this is really a reporting mechanism only. It takes no action to do anything about those threads. Chart 28. The timeouts, as I said, were specific to WebSphere application server for ZOS. We have our internal timers to monitor the application request dispatch when it, from the time that it hits the control region is when the timers are started. And if the request is still in dispatch when the timer pops, the default action we take is to add in the servant, and a replacement servant is started up to continue taking more work. Chart 29. One of the frequently asked questions that we get is, why don't you just add in a single thread? Why do you have to add in the entire servant? we do actually add in the particular thread, but the dispatch thread probably has Java on the call stack, and at this point in time, Java has no MVS recovery for us to be able to terminate a single thread. So Java's signal handler can't clean up the resources associated with that single thread that we might want to remove. For example, synchronization locks might still be held. So the loss of a single thread could still corrupt the entire process. Chart 30. Another problem is that when we do take this action to append the servant region, a byproduct is that other innocent work dispatched in that same servant will also get terminated. Throughput gets restricted while the servant restarts, such that the requests are held in the control region waiting for an available servant region to dispatch requests into. And if this is the last or only servant region back at that end, and work gets starts to pile up in the control region while we're waiting for that new servant to restart, and that can result in another timeout such that the work continues to wait in the control region, but as I said, the timer starts when the request hits the controller, which means it's still running while that servant is restarting. Chart 31. One of the new enhancements we introduced to help navigate this problem is something called auto pause. This functionality allows us that when no servants are up, to stop taking new work. It allows you to us to deregister from WLM, such that WLM will send the work to other servers that have that application installed, or whatever your routing mechanism is. And when the minimum number of servants are ready for work, then we can start resume taking work again. It can defer taking work until we're ready, also via a WTOR. And you set that through this control region, confirm recovery on no SRs, which gives you a little bit more control about when you think the servers are up and ready to really take work. And both of these environment variables are allowed to be set through modified commands as well for pause listeners and resume listeners. I've listed here which fixed packs and service levels. This shows up in the various releases. There's also more information about that in the info center. Chart 32. Another enhancement that we recently added is a grace period to help work with this as well. The idea behind when you would want to use this is if you have one long-running request or one set of types of that, but most of your work is short in duration, when that one long-running request does hit the timeout period, and we're ready at that point to take the servant down with the timeout abend, if you set this grace period for that amount of time, it'll let the rest of the work in the servant continue to run and hopefully try to finish up so that those requests wouldn't get caught as innocent bystanders. And was listed here again where this feature is available. Chart 33. Kind of as a follow-on question to that, it says, with this grace period, if I set it, and that long-running request that had timed out actually comes back within that grace period and finishes up, do you still have to add in the servant region? Unfortunately, the answer is yes, we still have to do that. Work with any affinity to the servants held in the WLM queues until we actually add in the servant region, so we wouldn't be able to redispatch that work that's waiting if we left that servant up. And if the servant resumes taking work, any of the delayed work would start timing out again, and we're back into the same boat of a servant region continually recycling. Chart 44, or 34. Another question that we've gotten a couple times is, you know, during that grace period, can you give us a head start and start up the replacement servant region right away? Unfortunately, the WLM controls the servants, and they won't see one that's actually going away until it's completely down. So even if we could do that, you might not want that behavior because you've specified potentially a max SR setting, that says you only want this number of servants to be the maximum to start up. So it could exceed connection limits or consume more memory or CPU if we started starting up more servants than you had planned for. Chart 35. Some timeout variables that are relevant to abending or not abending the servant region. These we've listed here, the ones, the first set that are listed are the timers that control the various types of timeouts. And right underneath that, we have a new set of configuration variables that will let you specify a percent that says if that percent isn't met, or if you've gotten that far, that percentage into the request already, you know that there won't be enough time left for the servant, for that request to run in the servant. It won't have a chance of finishing. So for example, if the dispatch takes 15 seconds or less, and your dispatch timeout sets to 30 seconds, you would want to set this queue timeout percentage to 50, which would say if you got halfway into that dispatch timeout, you know that there wouldn't be enough time left for that servant to request, so don't bother even dispatching it. And this is available in 6.1.0.11. Chart 36. The next couple of charts, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. These deal with preventing timeouts that when the request is an IAOP request. We see most of our work being done in HTTP and MQ. Some people do use IAOP, but I'd like to spend some time on the newer functionality for those rather than going through IOP. So I'm going to skip chart 36, skip 37, and skip 38. Starting back up again on chart 39, there's another option that's available now on timeouts, and it's available for both when the recovery is set to servant and also when it's set to session. So I'll talk on this chart about servant and the next chart about session. Typically, like I said, the default behavior when we encounter a timeout in a servant region is the default behavior is to abturn the servant region. Usually we get an SCC dump from that unless it's being suppressed by DAE or the MVS configuration. Some customers would prefer a Java dump over an SVC dump. It's smaller in size and it's faster to take. So we've added a new configuration option. When you have recovery set to servant and you also have control region timeout delay has to be set from non-zero in order to use this feature so that the servant isn't immediately abended. You have a grace period in there for us to attempt to take a Java core. And the environment variable to do that is listed here, the control region timeout dump action dump action equals Java core. If you set it to that, we will only take a Java core and not take an SVC dump right at that point that we detect the timeout. After the grace period, we will still attempt to take the SVC dump. And you can toggle this on or set it to none via the modify command. On chart 40, there's equivalent environment variable for when you have recovery set to session. And setting it to session says let the request run in the servant region. Tell the client that's waiting on the request that it timed out, but it will continue to run in the servant region indefinitely, and it could be tying up resources along the way, but some people prefer that a better option than abending the servant region. Prior to 6.1.11, we didn't have a good way of diagnosing when timeout might occur if you have recovery set to session to see exactly what it was doing. So again, with this new option, control region timeout dump action session, you can set that to Java core now and get a Java core dump to see what the threads were doing at the time of the timeout, even though that request is going to keep running. And again, you can set that via the modify command or set it to none. Chart 41. There's some, a couple of existing messages now. The one that we have now only tells you the class name and method name. We have another APAR here that gives you the MDB request as well. On chart 42, this new message that we put out shows, it gives you a little bit more information about the timeout when it occurs, including the servant ASID, when it was dispatched into the control region and picked up in the servant. These are some things that we usually look at for when we get a dump to look at timeouts, and I've listed here where these are available. This new message also comes out when you have the timeout actions at the session. Chart 43. One last thing I want to talk about with regards to servants, or with timeouts, is called the servant survivor. If you are configured with more than one servant region and you have this new environment variable, timeout save last servant, that we try to add in the servant region, but if there's only one left, the others have already been abandoned for timeouts and are in the middle of recycling, then we won't abandon the last servant until another one is fully initialized. This will only work if you have min SRs greater than one, because we always want to make sure that we have another servant that will be starting up. In that one servant that's remaining surviving, if the runaway request is timed out, is looping or consuming a lot of CPU, or if all the threads are tied up, you know, you'll still be in a stuck situation, but if it's not that case, you'll at least have one servant up that can still be taking work while the others are still coming up, and that's available in 6111. On chart 44, we have some charts here for additional information. As I mentioned, we weren't going to have time to get to them, so I'd like to skip ahead to chart 57 for a summary. One thing that we see over again with customers is, you know, stress test in pre-production as much as production as you like as you can. Keep us current on service levels, preferably within 6 months. We've listed the link here for where you can get our APAR PTF availability. Always have a backup of your configuration in case you need to restore it. And remember that you can always call on us at level 2 for help. Chart 58 and then 59, these are some additional resources. Again, you're very aware of the technical exchange. We've listed some prior interesting sessions that you may be interested in. Chart 60, there's a virtual WebSphere users group specifically for WebSphere ZOS. You may want to check there. There's some interesting presentations given through that avenue as well. Chart 62, we've just listed here some interesting APARs or references. On chart 62, we've listed some information APARs that we in level 2 maintain. If you use MQ, any of the Computer Associates security products, or DB2, you might want to check in on those info APARs frequently to see if there's any hot cross-referencing APARs you would need to pick up. And then on chart 64, I'd just like to conclude with this chart includes a link to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. Developer Works offers in-depth technical information. The events link on support pages points you to webcast and conference information. You can visit WebSphere.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up the learning curve quickly. And the My Support link on all support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products of interest to you.
At this time, we'll conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on the site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Nancy and Keith, for presenting today.